From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning in to Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 16, Episode 17. This week, Bob sat down with Melissa Moore, the daughter of Keith Jesperson, the serial killer known as the Happy Face Killer. I am back from assignment and joined by Bob and Janet, and the three of us have a lot to discuss. But before we get into that, do we have any housekeeping?
Yeah, probably just as much housekeeping as we have stuff to discuss about this one. It was a great episode. We got great feedback on it. Everybody loved Melissa. Not a lot of questions this week. That's fine. So we'll probably keep this pretty short and sweet today. Housekeeping-wise, just letting you guys know, reminding you that the kids podcast, the Underestimated podcast, on Wednesday this week, episode 2 of the Jeanette Robertson case drops on the feed. I can't get over how we're already writing the fourth episode of that series right now, because the third one will drop next week. So good if you haven't checked it out. And they're doing so good. They've like held... Their podcast is holding rankings in the top 50.
That's good.
Awesome. In the whole world. Yeah, they're doing fantastic. And so far, tons of great feedback. Jan, did you listen to the Underestimated yet?
Yeah, I've listened to all of them. I mean, I listen to them like within 5 minutes after they drop. I like stop what after I'm doing and then listen to it.
Yeah. Isn't the first Jeanette Robertson one so good?
It's fascinating. Yeah. I'm so pulled in by the idea that there's something that maybe wasn't taken seriously then that should have been, that needs to be.
Yeah. They've done such a good job of like building suspense into it and the way they're laying it out.
Yeah.
And so we're writing their fourth, and because we got so late into the school year, what I'm doing for their final is each group is doing a final 2 episodes instead of 3. They can do 3 if they feel like they have time, but they have to do at least two more in their follow-ups. They kind of leave you with one hell of a cliffhanger at the end of episode 3. And then when they come back, other groups will go. When they come back around, they're doing an episode where we're going to hear from Jim Clemente talking about how to build a profile. They're going to go through the process on the show of building their profile and how they came to it. And then in the final episode, they're going to apply that to the list of people of interest and then leave you with the information that when they gave to the state police investigator, he took immediate notice of it and was very interested in
That's
the information.
So amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Good stuff.
Don't want to give anything away more than that. Also, kind of housekeeping. This is weird. I'm not exactly. I've been thinking about this all day. How to address this? So, I guess I kind of walk through what happened. So yesterday, which was Monday for us, I had a comment on a Facebook post from almost a year ago, when I had published on my personal Facebook the first episode of season 15. And I had tagged Erica's mom in it. And, you know, there was some conversation. All of a sudden I get this comment on there from somebody just furious about this. Like, how dare you make a mockery of my brother's death and da, 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 da. I mean, it became apparent very, very quickly that it was Demario Lowe's sister.
Mm.
And so, you know, I start communicating kind of back and forth. I'm like, you know, I've been looking for you. I've been trying to find any relatives of Mara. And she's like, well, you didn't find me. And that, you know, she's going, and then eventually I was like, well, let's move over to private message so we can talk.
Yeah.
And start explaining, cause she hadn't listened to anything. So apparently what had happened was somebody had shared with her like, hey, they did a podcast about your brother's case. And her immediate reaction was, why is anybody doing this?
Mm-hmm.
And so we start talking, and she calmed down pretty quickly. I was like, because her Facebook handle is not her name.
Mm.
You know, I was like, there's no way I could possibly have known to look for that. Yeah. And so then when she calmed down, she started asking me like, well, what is it about? What did we do? And you know, told her we fully investigated it. We believe there's a wrongful conviction in that, and it's not. And she's like, well, I don't care about Hill. You know, I care about my brother. And I said, well, you know, I don't take cases on technicalities. I take them if I think somebody's truly innocent. And the big reason for that is because that means that whoever killed your brother, I don't believe ever was brought to justice. And that's our goal. She has to call me. So I got on the phone with her, talked to her for over an hour last night. And she was so sweet. And she was, you know, she was apologetic about kind of her reaction at the beginning. Cause she kind of, Erica's mom actually, cause she was, commenting on it before, you know, was like kind of talking to her a little bit about it. And then so she was, you know, there was conversation. She said, please pass my apologies on to your assistant's mom and everything. She was just very kind, very, very sweet woman. And I talked to her for over an hour. You know, she asked a lot about the case, went through everything that was going on, you know, what led us to the conclusions that we had gotten to. And she was very thankful for the work we're doing because I feel like nobody ever really cared and that the people care. So that was very nice. I asked her, and this is where I kind of run into kind of the dilemma. I said, you know, one thing that was always missing that drove me crazy about that season is we were never able to hear from anyone that knew Mario that could tell us about Mario. And she spent a half hour telling me about Mario and his background and his life and all these things. And it was beautiful. And I was like, do you want to come on the show? And, you know, I can interview you and you can just tell his story so that the world can hear it from you. And she said, I don't want to be a part of any podcast. I don't want to be put on display like that. I just want to, I'm thankful that you're doing something about it, but no, I don't want any spotlight on me or anything like that. So kind of left me and it wasn't even real clear if she was okay with me like even sharing any of the conversation, but I just feel like it's important for people to know because like our perception of who Mario was, I don't think really was accurate, you know, because all we know about him, right, is what we found from the police file that, you know, he lived in Benton Harbor. He seemed like a very likable, very social, friendly guy. And he was, you know, he was doing some small time dealing according to the police reports. But what we don't know about him is that, you know, he grew up with a family where he had lost his mom and his dad, and him and his sister had really struggled through life working, you know, and working hard to make a life for themselves. They spent most of their life, he spent most of his life working on a farm up in Eau Claire, and still up until the point where he died, he was working a job in Benton Harbor and was still helping family on the farm up there. So it was just kind of tragic too, that whole, like, because of this, I went back and re-listened to the first episode where we broke down, you know, kind of that cycle that people get stuck in the city. And it seems like from everything I know now, like that's kind of part of what was happening with Mario, you know, is that he lived there and he was kind of caught up in the things that were happening there, but he was still like trying to stay away from that and was pulled out of that. And was, said, every weekend was going to help the family on the farm still and doing all that. Of course, this was wintertime, so there's no farm work to do during that time. But without like getting too personal into all that stuff, I just thought that was worth sharing because it was it was touching for, I mean, she was crying, I was crying. It was, you know, just hearing these stories. I was glad I got to connect with her. And also, you know, she told me during that call that about a month ago or a couple of months, she wasn't sure exactly how long ago it was, that she got a call from the Attorney General's Conviction Integrity Unit office.
Oh.
Telling, and she's like, I didn't know. She's like, nobody's ever done anything for 23 years. And all of a sudden somebody's calling me and they just told me that, you know, they're working on the case and I'm getting all the details she shared. It's nothing like big. Like, I didn't tell her like some big bombshell is coming or anything like that. But I was thrilled to hear that because that tells me that they're still, you know, we know that they had went and visited Jody. We know that all the work they're doing, but they're still actively working and they evidently got to a point in the investigation from the AG's office where they felt it was time that they needed to notify the victim's family.
Yes.
That there's work being done.
That seems huge to me. I mean, I don't know, but that seems huge to me.
It does to me too. And it was also good to hear. So that how that came up was, she was like, but she said, what good does it do? And it was not like a backhanded question. Right. It was a serious question.
Yeah.
She said, what good does it do for you to do these cases on your podcast? And I was explaining to her, I was like, you know, our goal, what we want is to be able to get the investigation to a point where one, we can either solve it or hand it off to an official agency that can do something about it. And I said, in this case, you know, we now have, you know, I was in direct contact with the Attorney General's office who, you know, last I knew was actively looking into the case. And she's like, that makes sense because they called me last month.
What?
And they're doing something. And so, yeah, so that was... like I said, I'm struggling through because I don't want to, what's the word, you know, dishonor the privacy of the conversation that we were having. But I just think that it's good that people know that's a picture we were never able to paint of DeMario, because we never were able to speak to anybody other than Sonia Lucas, who just said, he was like her friend. He was just he was a good dude is the best we got out of it. But
yeah,
seems like it really truly was. And it was really, really very tragic, obviously, what happened to him. And then the good news is that hopefully that there's something still happening and we're going to get some news on it. And obviously that, getting Jody, who's innocent, out of prison is a huge piece of that, but also bringing DeMario's true killer to justice was a big deal. That would be amazing if we're able to get that done, or if the Attorney General's office is able to get that done. So I'm going to leave it at that before I ramble and betray trust more than I need to. But just wanted to share that with you guys, and we have a little bit of time today because we have a lot of questions. So
I'm just happy that happened. I'm happy that she reached out to you.
Me too. And it was so sad at first, because it was like, oh, like we finally found a family member and she's mad. Mm-hmm. But then it was like, it came, once the conversation happened, it was like she didn't know what the podcast was. I think she was just picturing somebody just like telling the story for an episode.
Of course. Yeah. There's no part of, I'm sure, any of us that feels like that was an inappropriate response at first. Like, it's completely understandable that she would have that reaction. And the fact that she was willing to listen, even coming from that place of pain and anger, and still hear and respond and like get to a place where she had a conversation with you, I think she's a hero. I have nothing but respect for her. I think that's a really special person. Yeah, she has my, really my major respect.
Yeah. And I had reached out because she insisted that I reach out to Erica's mom, because, there was not on her mom's part, but on.
Yeah.
I didn't want to say their name, but this person's part was kind of heated. And she was just like, please apologize. Bless you. Bless this Erica girl that works for you. And please apologize. And of course, Erica's mom was like, she doesn't owe me an apology. Like, I 100% get it. So it turned out, like, to me, it was just the whole situation was very heartwarming when it was over. Like, after I got off the phone with her, then it was great. And it was just so nice to be able to, especially not, a lot of this job, we're going to talk to somebody. Let's turn on the microphones. Let's turn on the stuff. Let's capture it. That it was like, not for production. It was just let's just have a very real conversation, because she's upset and she wants answers. So I'm going to sit down and give her those answers. So
really,
that being said, we can move on from that. And hopefully very soon we'll have. I want to be clear. I'm not being coy about that. I have no idea what's happening.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that very soon we'll have some kind of response. Do you think you only need sunscreen in the summer? UV rays are sneaky. Not to mention things like pollution and blue light exposure that quietly wreak havoc on your skin, speeding up cellular aging. That's why you need a broad-spectrum sunscreen every day. My favorites, and definitely my wife Becky's favorites, OneSkin's SPFs for the face and body. OneSkin is the only skin longevity company proven to reverse cellular aging. Their SPFs block UV rays with non-nano zinc oxide and neutralize the free radicals that come from UV, pollution, and blue light with a potent blend of antioxidants. The mastermind ingredient behind it all is OneSkin's OS1 peptide, the first ingredient to target a root cause of skin aging, cellular senescence. And you'll only find OS1 in OneSkin's line. So be sure to add OS1 Face SPF and OS1 Body SPF to your daily routine. Head over to oneskin.co and use code JUSTICE to save 15% on your first purchase. Now, I already mentioned that Becky loves OneSkin's SPF for the face and body, but she uses a ton of their products. She just discovered OneSkin's products about 2 months ago, and they've quickly become part of her daily routine. And since then, her face has been glowing like never before, and she's always talking about how healthy her skin has become. She was actually the one who recommended OneSkin's face and body SPFs for me. And let me tell you, they work. They protect and hydrate my skin and don't feel heavy or oily on my face. I use it primarily for the benefits of the sunscreen, but all of OneSkin's products do so much more than you may realize. OneSkin's OS1 works at the cellular level to improve key aging biomarkers while reducing the visible signs of aging, including lines, wrinkles, and sagging skin. They were founded and led by an all-woman team of skin longevity scientists. OneSkin is redefining the aging process with their proprietary OS1 peptide, the first ingredient proven to help skin look, feel, and behave like its younger self. You can get 15% off with code JUSTICE at OneSkin.com. oneskin.co. That's 15% off at oneskin.co with code JUSTICE. And after you purchase, they'll ask where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them that we sent you. Invest in the health and longevity of your skin with OneSkin. Your future self will thank you. All right, so now we can get into talking about the episode with Melissa. Like I said, it was, I don't know what you guys love, but I enjoyed that conversation. We were just talking about a conversation. I enjoyed my conversation with her so much. I want to hang out with Melissa. I've got to hang out with her one time in person. And the more we talked, I was like, what a fun, it's obviously tragic circumstances, but what a fun conversation. And just, I just love how much she and I were able to connect.
Well, and that's, so where I sat on it was a very fun conversation. I enjoyed listening to you guys talk about the production and all the different things.
Mm-hmm.
But it also drove me nuts that I was like, I want to know more about this. I want to know more about her story. I know she's got a book. I need to go get the book and I need to read the book or listen to
her podcast.
And she has a podcast.
Because we know you, I mean.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was going to get the audio book. I wasn't going to read the book. I was going to get the audio book. But what I'm saying is like, I was listening to your guys' conversation, which was a great conversation and fun. But the whole time I'm like, oh, I got questions. I want to know answers. I need more to this. Like, more about her life. You know, I mean, you kind of touched on a little bit, like asking like, well, when this came out, you know, how was that in school? But that I wanted to hear more of that.
Yeah. Can you imagine 15 years old?
Oh, it's.
And the biggest thing to me was, when I've listened to all of her podcasts a long time ago.
Yeah, me too.
I haven't read her book, but now I've been watching Happy Face. Mm-hmm. It's so good. It's obviously scripted. It's fictional.
Yeah.
There's actors she doesn't know in it.
Yeah, clearly.
But it's really, really, really well done on Paramount Plus.
I have a hard time with fictional, like scripted true crime stuff, though.
This is one that if you watch it, like if you just sat down to watch it like this, like, and weren't even thinking about like this is based on a true story, mm-hmm. it's just a really good series.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's a really good dramatic series.
I just have such a hard time with that.
Yeah.
Like, because I like documentaries. Like, I will settle in and watch documentary after documentary. Right. But once they get to like the scripted stuff, that's where it kind of loses me usually.
Yeah.
Well, it's been done poorly and it's been done well. And when it's done poorly, it's really bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. This one is not that.
Yeah.
And it's kind of surprising. I don't want to give anything away, but like it's surprising how it starts. Like I'm picturing like a high school girl and there's some time jumping it's just really well done. Really, really well
done. But the idea, like you said, the idea of that to just be a teenager. And all of a sudden you find out that your father is a monster, essentially.
Yeah. And that's the big thing is like to have no idea.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing if you're like, suspect something, he's a bad guy. You have these, and you're like, but it's like, he's just my dad, good old dad. Like that could be your dad, my dad, anybody. And all of a sudden find out like what?
Yeah.
Like he's a serial killer. Like, can you imagine that? And you're in high school.
Yeah. Well, you know, to get way off in the weeds. I was thinking about that when the Bridge Guy stuff came out.
Uh-huh.
When you start seeing photos of Bridge Guy and you're like, is this somebody I actually know? You know, because it was so random. Like, it's so hard to see and you so hard, you know, there was so little to, but you start having those thoughts of like, well, do I know this person?
Right. Mm-hmm. Especially for us, it's not that far from us.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, because it could have been anybody. I mean, you know, we know who has been convicted of it, regardless of where you feel. But like at the time when it was being released, no one knew anything.
Right.
So that idea of like, this could be my dad. This could be my brother. This could, probably not my brother. My brother's a different color.
Think of like Richard Allen's wife, right? You know, whether he's innocent or guilty, like having those same thoughts, like who is that guy? Who is it? And they're going to catch one. And then all of a sudden the police knock on the door and they're like, it's your husband.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. The same type of feeling.
Yeah.
What'd you think about the episode? You said you've listened to Melissa's podcast?
Yeah, I listened to Melissa's podcast. I thought it was great. I haven't seen the series yet, but shout out to Annalee Ashford, who you mentioned, who's playing Melissa. You said, she looks so much like you. I thought it was you, but it couldn't be you because you aren't an actor. And I'm very familiar with her work, and she is phenomenal. Everything I've ever seen her in, including Masters of Sex, which I think was the first thing I saw her in, she just really stands out, you know? She's just like, she's got it.
Yeah.
And yet she's also, you know, when people say that, like when you imagine the sort of, you know, ethereal star-like quality, it's not that. It's that she is so real and so human and just a person And it feels so real because she's so connected to the characters that she plays. And so I have absolutely no doubt in my mind that she does a phenomenal job in this series. I don't think she's capable of anything less.
Exactly what you just described. So like in the first episode, the first act, like it's like she obviously is the primary driver. And that's what hooked me into the whole series, because it's like you believe 100%. Like, and she, like the range of emotion, and we're not usually a pop culture podcast, but for me, like it was like the range of emotions that she displays in her acting in the first 10 minutes of that series is so good. It's Paramount Plus. It's worth a watch.
Yeah.
If you have it.
Well, I don't have it, so I can't watch it.
Maybe you could tell us that you want to come over and hang out with us to watch it.
I got chastised for doing that one time. I wanted to watch a movie that we didn't have.
Yeah.
Because it was on one of those.
Yep.
I'll tell you, I was with you when we met Melissa in Austin.
Yep.
And that was my first wake-up call to this, that truly wake-up call to like this true crime world.
Mm. Yeah.
Because we're standing in podcast row. We're with the Gen Y guys right next to them, and we're talking to them, and we're having a good time, and people are meeting us and taking pictures. And then we meet Melissa, and I'm like, this is a person that's lived through this.
Yeah.
You know, like we're here talking about this. This is a person that has lived this.
Yeah.
And it was just such a crazy like thing to try to wrap my head around at the time, just being in person talking to her.
Yeah. She was one. And I think it was a crime con before you were there, like the first time I met Kelsey German, speaking of the Delphi case, he's coming back and like sat and had conversations with Kelsey. It was just like, wow, like it as a creator in the space, it really gives you that gut check about being trying to be as
ethical.
As ethical as possible in presenting this work. Because when I first met Kelsey, I was on a panel with her that was about true crime ethics and reporting and how it affects like victims' families and things like that. So she was on the panel with me. So it was like that very real conversation of like, oh, we're not just like saying stuff to be entertaining. Like this is affecting, just like with Mario's sister, like this is affecting real people. You know, in her case, you know, I felt good about too, because by the time I got on the phone with her, she had listened to a couple episodes. So like once she listened to it, was like, oh, this is okay. This is not what I thought I was going to hear, you know? So she was okay. So that made me feel good that like that kind of what calmed her down in the situation.
Nice. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, and as you were saying, Zach, you know, this was not a conversation that was heavy and hard and dark. And I think there may be people who, you know, have that say like, well, that's not fair. Like you should stay, you know, everything about this is so dark and so hard. It can only stay in that space. And that's such a disservice to Melissa in terms of like, she didn't do anything. Mm-hmm. She deserves
you're absolutely right.
to have a life that still has joy. And if something comes of this horrific experience, as long as she's acting ethically, which we know her to be, in terms of the other victims, but like she is a victim. And I thought she was very gracious the way, you know, she sort of downplayed her experience. And obviously, yes, it is different. It's a different kind of victimization to be a family member of an offender like her father. But she didn't ask for that to happen. And so the fact that she has, you know, been able to move not past it, but move along through the world with it in a way that has allowed her to process it and also, you know, get some joy and, you know, feel some joy in her life. And it's like when something like that happens, I have certainly not had this experience, but it's such a part of who you are that to pretend that like that has to exist over here. And then anything that gives you any kind of happiness has to be on the polar opposite of your life. I think that's impossible. So everything's intertwined, and you just live with that and still try to find joy, you know?
And there's a ripple effect that I think a lot of people don't think about. And I think the conversation with her kind of helped drive that home. You know, again, like you said, she was so gracious and so insistent to say, like, I'm not a victim. I'm at least not the level of victim of the people that were killed. But she is still a victim in this. Like, and there, in everybody, like, her mother, family members, friends, like that ripple, like when something this dramatic and tragic happens, that affects so many people as those waves, as those ripples go out, you know, and like what you were just talking about, Amanda Knox, the first time I talked to her,
sure,
you know, she was talking about that. I had her on, I remember it was on this show, it was on True Crime Binge when I talked to Amanda on the show. I've talked to her several times, but you know, she talked about how, you know, in her case, like, there's still people out there that say that she's guilty. It's nonsense.
Insane.
It's absolute nonsense. Not only she's innocent, they know who did it. Like, give me a,
yeah, it's anyway, silly. It's
not going to go down, but she has talked about, like, and she's such a powerful woman too, because she has, like, finally said, you know, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not pretending that I can't live my life because of this. It's tragic what happened there, and she feels terrible for it, but she has to live her life, and she didn't do it.
Right.
But she said, you know, if she were to post on social media, like when she posted that she was getting married, she talked about, like, you know, she got engaged and people are like, oh, you get to be engaged, but the victim, you know, it's constant. Kelsey German had this when I had her on the show and talked, yeah, to her, that was on this show, I think, one time. Yeah. She's the same thing. She got engaged, and she, now in Amanda's case, you know, it was, you know, there are people like, you were accused of this crime. Some people say things she's guilty, but even people that didn't think she's guilty still think she shouldn't be able to live her life. In Kelsey's case, like, no one ever thought Kelsey had something to do with it. It's just her sister was murdered. And like when she got engaged, it was the same thing. People were like, how can you even move on? How can you be happy when your sister was murdered? And it's just like, people are just so insensitive to that. And it just lets you know, like, how difficult it is to, you know, as part of that ripple effect for people that are affected besides the victim, people, you know, around them that get hit with the ripples of that tragedy, how it continues to affect their life years later. I mean, imagine feeling, you know, when something good happens in your life, feeling guilty about being happy.
Right.
And that's all, like, both, you know, especially Kelsey, like, talked about that.
Yeah.
Like, it's horrible to feel like this great thing's happening to me that's never going to happen for Libby. And so I want to be happy about it, but then part of me feels like I shouldn't be happy about it.
Right.
So, you know, that's just something, and I know I'm preaching to the choir with our audience, but I hope it's a message that gets out more, a message that, you know, Melissa, you know, and besides just like living with it, you know, she's made an effort to help other people along the way to deal with it. And I just think that's amazing.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, in terms of comments, you know, we had definitely the handful that we got, people were very sympathetic. You know, I echo Kathy, who went on to post and remind, yeah, and to say, like, you are a victim, Melissa. That's okay. It's okay to acknowledge, yeah, that people who are touched by this kind of crime are, that it is, that those ripples exist. So definitely she gets it. Definitely support there. Michelle just says, I moved to Spokane in 2001 and had no idea that the Happy Face killings had a local connection. I heard of Robert Yates. Was this case highly publicized at the time? Do we just hear more nowadays due to podcasts? And I don't know much about that. I don't know much about Robert Yates.
I don't know much about Jesperson either. And that's, you know, that's, I'm kind of, as you guys know, like, I'm not,
yeah,
into true crime. I'm definitely not into serial killers. My wife probably knows more about it, but I think, you know, there was enough that there was this whole, because the whole deal with Jesperson was that, you know, that he not only murdered these people, but then also, like, taunted police. Like, I think it was the police. He would send letters and then sign it with a smiley face. That's why they called him the happy face killer. So I think it was pretty widely publicized. I know the name Yates, but I don't know really anything about that case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't either. And then Monica says, I say this about capital punishment. Why create more victims, more violence? Why drag victims and their families through years of media, court hearings, and appeals? Appeals are necessary, as we've seen. Are there crimes that deserve the death penalty? Absolutely. But is it appropriate? I no longer think so.
No, I'm not sure how that connects to here, unless there's a connection I'm missing.
I think that the idea of, like, just victim, like, re-victimizing victims and kind of the way things handled.
Yeah.
So that there, you know, it just sort of perpetuates on and on, instead of, you know, what people think is going to happen, which is like, this is what justice looks like. And it's not, it's often not that simple in so many different ways.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, my views on the death penalty are very strong, and they've been, as I've talked about several times on the podcast, they've changed over the years. Before, when I was completely ignorant of the law or of the system, I should say, you know, I was one of those people that was like, well, yeah, if you kill somebody, they should kill you back. You know, that made sense to me.
Well, yeah.
And then you start to learn, you know, as far as like there are crimes where the death penalty is deserved. I don't personally, and everybody's entitled to their opinion. I'm not disagreeing with someone's opinion. That's their opinion. But I feel now that there is nothing. It doesn't fix anything. You know what I mean? I feel like there's so many different reasons why I'm opposed to the death penalty. One of which, and the one that stands out the most to me, that makes the most sense, is we work in a space where we investigate these wrongful convictions. And what we found is that jurors can and do get it wrong often.
Right.
I'm not saying the majority of the time or an overwhelming majority, but they get it wrong. It happens. That's why exonerations happen. And there have been, 200 people that have been exonerated posthumously, like after they were dead or put to death, it was found out later they were innocent. So I think that at the very least, you should consider the fact that if you have a system that's fallible, that can make mistakes, then the punishment should never, ever be something that you can't take back. And taking away years of someone's life is bad enough.
Right.
That's horrific in its own self. But at least they can walk free again. They can still go on living, you know, however hard that may be. But to take someone's life in a system that could make mistakes, I just think, like, even if you get it wrong once, it's too many times.
Right.
And then there's the cost benefit side of it. Like, what are you like where's the benefit?
Yeah.
You know, you just talked about one of the big costs, which is the years and years of appeals, the families being drugged back in and back in and back in and back into court for all these appeals. And then, you know, so 20, 30 years later, someone's finally put to death. Does that really bring closure? I don't know, but I don't feel like it. Probably is real common for someone to see the person put to death and be like, oh, I feel better now.
Right.
You know, maybe in a moment, I don't think the benefit outweighs the cost at all. And then there's the argument of deterrence. To me, the deterrence argument is the biggest crock of shit in the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't believe that it's ever happened. First of all, most murders aren't premeditated, despite what TV shows you.
Right.
Most murders aren't well thought out and planned and executed. Most of the time, they're happening in kind of the spur of the moment. And I mean, overwhelmingly, mm-hmm. the most of the time. So there's not even a thought process thinking about consequences in general, but even those premeditated ones, I refuse to believe, and I don't know if there's any way to empirically show this, but I refuse to believe that anyone ever has been like, I'm going to murder this person and I'm going to murder them because here, if I get caught, I only go to prison for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
Or on the converse side of that thought, I'm going to murder them. Oh, wait, if I get caught,
yeah,
they're going to kill me instead of me being in prison for the rest of my life.
No, I agree.
I don't believe that factors in at all.
Yeah.
Like not even a little bit.
No, I agree.
Because the thought is, I'm not going to get caught.
Yeah.
Like the consequence, I don't think like the severity of the consequence, it's not like you're like, well, if I get caught, I might get probation for this, or in this state, if I get caught, I might go to prison for 10 years. You might think twice about robbing that convenience store.
Right.
But if it's rest of my life in prison or 20 to 30 years in prison before they kill me, I do not believe that plays aside. I don't think deterrence is a role. I don't think the cost benefit adds up to it. And it's a system that's fallible and we shouldn't be killing people. And then there's also either murder's right or it's wrong.
Right.
I don't believe in state-sponsored murder either. Like if our contention is that it's not okay to intentionally take someone's life, then to be like, unless you do it and we catch you, then we're going to intentionally take your life.
Yeah, like, I mean,
state-sponsored murder.
That one is. I mean, I don't want to say I can set it aside, but that one is the easiest. I mean, in terms of like what of like a person, the people, if it is, quote unquote, definitively proven which I agree with you 1000%, is like a question mark too often, then I understand the idea of like it not being the same. Like I remember hearing like John Douglas talk about that. Like, don't, please don't say that as authorities who are trying to like, you know, keep order from chaos, if the determination is this person is, has murdered a lot of people, and like we've made this certain rule that we are not doing it as murder, we're doing it because that is what is justice looks like for the victims' families, and et cetera. I'm not saying I set that aside, like, but I understand that argument. I think just, but also, and I don't think we really touched on this, but in terms of statistics and stuff, it's also just feels so subjective. Like from one state to another, if you, you know, like a white person could commit the same crime and not get the death penalty, and then a black person gets the death. It's like all of that is so subjective and just squishy and gray area. And all of that is just so messy that it's like, what are we doing? Like
everything from racial disparity
to y'all.
Financial disparities could change things. You could get the death penalty or not get the death penalty depending if there's an election coming up.
Right. Right. Yeah. That's
like
crazy.
Like if you, we just can't do if it. if you're filling the baskets of the pros and cons of it, like to me, it's not even a close argument. Yeah. It's not even, and it bothers me when I look back at my own views on it in the past, that there was a time where I thought it was a good idea, where now, like when I really think it through and break it down piece by piece, it's like, this is stupid.
And
this
you
is
know,
the dumbest thing ever.
We should have, I think that part of that is just having grace around people who, you know, remember you were one of those people. And that's one of the things that I appreciate about you that I like to think we try to foster in this community, which is remember that you didn't have all the information once too. And, you know, and to give grace to people and to allow the possibility for people to change their mind, and that's make room for that. Like, that's a good thing, you know?
Yeah. I think in society in general, if we gave people a little grace for ignorance, and I don't say ignorance in an insulting way, but
just actual lack of information, actual lack of teaching, actual lack of understanding. Yeah.
Yeah. There's so many things that you can go into where you can have a conversation where if you like step back and be like, what if that person doesn't hold that viewpoint because they're evil? What if they hold that viewpoint because they don't understand?
Right.
Or in the world they've lived in, this is what has always made sense. And if we had some grace and help to educate people, that maybe it would make a difference.
Yeah.
That's your Bob Ruff preach for the week.
Yeah. Fine with me.
Yeah. And with that, like I said, we had a couple of questions, right? Or a couple of comments. Yeah. So we'll go ahead and wrap that. We're not going to drag this out any longer. I've yapped a lot already. For this week's episode coming up on Sunday, not real sure yet. It's Tuesday right now. I've been trying to like keep things that are, you know, that are happening in the news right now as we're doing these off episodes while we're preparing for it. And Erica's like, she's already has the full outline done for the first episode of season 17, where she's working tomorrow and Thursday this week on the second episode. So we're plugging along. We've got calls into our emails into the lawyers to see where we can get interviews to fill in some of these gaps and stuff and who we can contact. So we're moving right along with that. As of Tuesday, I wasn't sure what we were going to cover this week. And then just shortly before we came on the air, I saw that the interrogation video for Richard Allen was just released today.
Oh.
The full hour and 20 minute interrogation that Bob Mata has talked about.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. So I think it may be something around that. What I would kind of like to do, rather than bring somebody on to talk about it, if I'm able to and I have time, is to actually go through it myself and do an analysis on it. Mm-hmm. Based on, you know, without having all the information, just on, you know, the experience that I have from the gyms, Jim Clemente and Jim Fitzgerald, that have helped me with like statement analysis stuff, and just kind of give you my take on it and a breakdown of that. Or I may bring somebody on to do that. Mm-hmm. I don't know for sure that's what's going to happen. So I know for you guys, you're hearing this, it's Friday and you're like, dude, the episode drops in 2 days. What do you mean? It's only Tuesday for us.
Yeah.
So we'll see how that shakes out over the next couple of days. But that's kind of what I'm leaning towards. That's the type of thing when it comes to true crime that does interest me. Mm-hmm. Is not hearing about serial killers, but a behavioral analysis and like seeing, you know, this is a person that was convicted. What did this look like when it began?
Right.
When they first sat down and questioning him, and what things was he saying and doing in that sure. process. So I'm leaning towards that's where we're going on Sunday. But I don't know, Sunday morning, you'll be surprised.
Okay.
So
sounds good.
That's the not plan for what we're going to do this week. It's hard.
I like it.
Yeah. Zach walked in today and was excited because
the office is very interesting looking.
Oh. Again.
Yeah.
So between seasons, it's very like bland. Mm-hmm. But now I walked into the office and it is.
Whiteboards full, corkboards full. Yep. Like we're, because Eric and I had, I was off on spring break last week. So Eric and I got to actually like be in here all day and work together and start to.
He doesn't have the yarn out yet. Okay. But it's right. Coming.
It's because we didn't like the map we got. So we bought a new map.
Okay.
Yeah. So we. The yarn's coming. Yeah. But yeah, so when you walked in, you can see where my brain's at right now.
Uh-huh.
My brain is on season 17 in that case.
Exciting.
So we're plugging along.
Great.
So with that being said, we're going to let you guys go. Man, every time I think it's going to be a 15-minute episode, here we are.
I know.
40 minutes.
Yep.
Yeah.
We did it.
Yapper. All right, guys. We love you guys. Thanks so much for joining us and supporting us, especially our patrons. Thank you guys so much for helping us keep the lights on. And we'll talk to you guys next week.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music for season 15 is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @TruthJusticePod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.